probably the latter.
Started here, yes.
Yeah, plus with the French cuffs.
They get go all, over this with
yeah,
you.
On the edge.
Call to order the House Committee on Health Care for this happy March 25th. And announce for everybody who's here, who's interested, that House Bill 2642 will be carried over till the next meeting, which is next Monday. Do we have all our members yet?
Not quite, huh?
No.
Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2027. Madam Administrator, what do we got?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2027 requires the Oregon Health Authority Metrics and Scoring Committee to adopt at least two outcome and quality measures for oral health care that is provided by the coordinated care organizations. And we have.
Do we have a legislator on this one?
I worked on it, but it's a committee bill.
Okay. Call the first panel.
Okay. We have. Let's just bring Kelly Barnes up. And I'm not sure. Yeah, no. She's against it, so she's.
All right.
So I'm going to find out Kelly Barnes is.
Please introduce yourself.
Hello, good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and Healthcare Committee members. Thank you for hearing testimony on House Bill 2027. My name is Kelly Barnes. I'm here as a citizen interested in improved oral health in our community. And I feel that House Bill 2027 is very important for improved oral health delivery in our community, particularly for children most at risk for dental disease. While it is true that OHA has a scoring committee for adoption of CCO metrics, as well as a DCO scoring committee for DCO metrics, Oregon citizens could benefit from an additional DCO metric. Stated simply, metrics drive and our implementation for incentives of care. We heard during the City Club testimony for the research on dental care through Multnomah County that they also feel that metrics drive incentives for care. Right now, currently, of the 16 accepted CCO metrics, only one pertains to oral health. As a comparison, there are two metrics for mental health. The sole DCO metric is that of sealant placements on permanent molars. And while I do support that sealant programs and expanded sealant programs are helpful for prevention of caries, this leaves a large gap in coverage for young children that don't yet have molars, as well as children that don't qualify for the sealant program. If you review the current dental bills and proposed dental grants for funding this legislative session, you will see there are no bills or proposals for funding that include the topic of fluoride varnish, with the exception of legislative concepts proposed by the collaborative efforts of Mel Rader, the Executive Director of Upstream Public Health, and myself, with the support of Representative Kenny Geyer and Hayden. I feel that one component there may not be additional legislative efforts for fluoride varnish as a preventative service is due to the fact there's currently one DCO metric incentivizing care. In addition, we heard on testimony on 320 that fluoride varnish current DMAP fee schedule reimbursement is below national average. This may also not allow an incentive of care for dental providers to provide the preventative service that is highly effective in production of caries rates due to the fact that reimbursement rates are below national averages. Stated otherwise, it may not be a robust model for business. You may hear today that there's testimony concerned about this bill, either from CCOs or DCOs directly. You may hear that this is in relation to Senate Bill 440. I just want you to know that this legislative effort does not contradict the efforts of Senate Bill 440. And in fact, we would welcome collaborative efforts of having two DCO metrics included under that current Senate bill. In addition, you may hear that the current infrastructure does not allow for additional metrics under DCO, just now coming under CCOs. I would argue that such a metric, either of a dental visit or preventative fluoride varnish, allows further collaborative efforts between medical providers and dental providers, in which we are actually trying to do that under the transformation of healthcare. While infrastructure may be lacking, we can surely do better, and allowing metrics with data collection will allow improved outcome in dental care in the future. While I do think, again, that CLNs are incredibly good programs at reduction of caries, they are already incentivized under the CCO metrics and the sole DCO metric that's allowed it. We currently are seeing Senate bills that are asking for reimbursements or expanded of CLN programs that are already reimbursed under a CCO plan. I would argue that if we have an additional CCO, a DCO metric, that it would further allow more preventative care on the front end, thereby reducing costs later for the state. I would also recommend that the current DCO metric committee, while I respect all the members on it, they currently represent CCOs, DCOs, and those that have worked in dental care. I might argue that there might be a benefit to have a citizen member that might have a different take or look in how we score and allot metrics in our system. I am a healthcare provider. I understand outcome. I do understand healthcare metrics and why they're important. I simply think that dental care needs one additional metric to truly help children most in need in our community. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the witness? Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Please call the next panel.
Deborah Loy, yes, and Deborah Farr, or Debbie Farr.
Okay. This was pretty amazing.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee. My name is Debbie Farr. I'm the Director of Public and Government Affairs with Trillium Community Health Plan. And as the bill is currently written, we oppose the legislation, not because we don't believe in fluoride varnish. In fact, quite the contrary. In 2013, Trillium actually paid for a fluoride varnish pilot project that we did in pediatric offices, and it was very successful. And in 2015, it is now a covered benefit. But regarding the legislation, we don't want to see metrics that are required in statute, and that's why we have a metrics and scoring committee. We do have a brand new dental measure that just took effect in 2015, and it's a good one that you heard already about sealants, and we definitely support that. And in the future, there probably will be additional dental metrics in that committee. These are part of our financial incentive measures. And I'm here with my cohort Deborah Lloyd to talk about this from the DCO perspective.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Deborah Loy, and I'm the Executive Director of Government Programs for Capital Dental Care. We're one of the larger dental care organizations delivering services under the Oregon Health Plan and our CCO partners. I also was on the advisory group that worked on the oral health metrics, so we did a lot of vetting. We had a professional consultant to the work group on who helped us identify national type metrics that we should evaluate, because that was one of the key things that we were asked to do as members of that advisory committee, was to come up with metrics that had some sort of national basis, had been in place nationally previously. I also was one of the scoring committee or advisory group members who testified and spoke to the full metric scoring committee. There actually were two dental metrics proposed at one time. The scoring committee elected only to be able to accept one of them as a performance metric, an incentivized metric. The two that were proposed were actually the sealant metric, and it was a penetration, or how many people had actually sought a dental service and got a dental service within a year's time. As I said, the scoring committee only accepted the sealant metric. We were asked to sort of regroup because one of the comments when we were presenting the two metrics was not wanting to have more than one metric that was only focused on children, because the Oregon Health Plan includes coverage for both children and adults, and pregnant women were an important topic that was asked by the committee members. So we did regroup. We did present other metrics that had to do with pregnant women, and again, we were only allowed to do the one metric under the performance incentive metric. So I also, too, very much believe in fluoride varnish. We have some things as a metric sort of fact-finding we're doing that the agency has been asked to collect, because not only dentists can do or dental providers can do fluoride varnish, so can medical. And part of our work was to also study or collect some of this in preparation for what future metrics we might offer. I would agree with Debbie's testimony that there is another vehicle that's being worked on, Senate Bill 440, and that would be a better place to have this discussion and vet this. And also, as a result of the work group that I was on, there was a dentist, Dr. Eli Schwartz, who was added as an official member to the metric scoring committee. And so he, too, will be able to continue to have a voice and an eye out for oral health metrics.
Thank you. Are there any questions of these witnesses?
Kenny Geyer.
Thank you for coming to testify. You may have been a part of a group that I was meeting with in December and January where we looked at an earlier version of this which had four dental metrics that were kind of very prescribed. And the feedback from the group was very similar to what you're saying now, which was you are not in favor of having a particular prescribed metric. The bill actually doesn't call for one, and so I'm not sure if you're responding to an earlier draft than what actually ended up coming out, or if you're responding to the testimony that maybe you saw online, you know, because you focused on fluoride varnish. There's nothing in here that says that. What this bill calls for is there's currently a process in place, and I recognize that Senate Bill 440 is calling for a different kind of process in place to identify what the metrics are, but whoever is doing it, however that gets structured, the only thing that this bill is doing is saying that we should go from one to at least two. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing the bill says. It says the outcome and quality measures adopted by the committee must include at least two measures for oral health care. We felt that one out of the 16 or 17 is really, really little, and I understand the history. The dental care ended up getting integrated later than the mental health care. And so there's a big cry in the community for making sure that we have at least one more. It doesn't say, in fact, when I've gone around and talked to the public health director and the new dental director and others, there seems to be a lot of support for the idea of having more performance metrics, especially if it could be incentive metrics. That would certainly help the DCOs. And a lot of what they've looked at is not another activity or measure like a sealant, but more how do you measure either timeliness or integration of the systems or something like that. So it gives an opportunity. So that's all the bill does now, just to be really, really clear. And with that, I'm wondering, are you still opposed to that idea of having at least two metrics?
So Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer, I threw in the comments about fluoride varnish just because of the previous testimony.
Oh, okay.
And I just wanted to let you know that we do support that. I think that what we are not in favor of is having any of the measures statutorily required.
Mm-hmm.
Let the Metrics and Scoring Committee, you know, with CCO and DCO input, decide what measures should move forward.
But are you opposed to having at least two, not saying what they are?
Well,
you're
it would
okay
be,
with it?
Not if it's statutorily required. None of the other incentive measures are statutorily required.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And my understanding, and I'm not a metrics and scoring person expert, is there are X amount of metrics that can be there. So basically to, which is when we testified or when we asked for two to be considered at the beginning, something else will have to be removed for, and you know, as an oral health person,
yeah.
I mean, I'm all for it. But I also saw a lot of other important metrics in that listing too. So mm-hmm. I too wouldn't mind if a oral health metric is important enough that the metric scoring committee votes that way, but I also am sensitive to the fact that there were some pretty important things on that list that if that is going to have to displace another for another dental metric, that's an important weighing decision for the scoring committee to make.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Do you know anything about this?
No. But I'd like to ask one question.
Try Dr. Hayden.
Chair Greenlee, if the metrics committee all of a sudden decided that oral health had a requirement of four matrices or metrics that are followed, would you prefer to have two in statute?
We prefer not to have any in statute.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2027 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2302. What do we have here, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2302 modifies the definition of a prepaid managed care health service organization, declares an emergency effective on passage. On OLAS, there's a dash two amendment, which replaces the bill, and they will be speaking to the dash two amendment, Mr. Chair. And we have Deborah Loy.
Okay.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Deborah Loy, and I'm the Executive Director of Government Programs for Capital Dental Care. We're a dental care organization with the Oregon Health Plan. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2302, the dash two amendments. I've also submitted written testimony, and I won't read it prescriptively, but I will try to draw attention to a few of the points in the testimony. The reason for introducing House Bill 2302 was to address the unintended consequences resulting from House Bill 3650, which was passed in 2011, and Senate Bill 1580, which was passed in 2012, which established the Oregon Integrated Coordinated Health Care Delivery System. The issues that House Bill 2302 are intending to address are: on July 1st, 2017, a prepaid managed care health services organizations are eliminated. This legal status allows a organization like mine, which is not a commercial insurance company, to operate and do many of the very same things like pay claims, hold reserves, make utilization decisions, all those things that are oftentimes associated with an insurance company, to be able to do those things without requiring us to be a commercial insurer. So House Bill 2302 revises the definition of the prepaid health plan to address this issue. It would allow a dental care organization such as mine to continue to be legally able to do those types of services without needing to hold an insurer certificate. The legal status of the prepaid health plan, including a DCO, not having to hold a certificate of insurance, was primarily worded in such a way that it would be if I was a direct contractor with the state of Oregon. And on July 1st or before, many or all of the dental plans contracted with the appropriate coordinated care organizations and became subcontractors to them. So this bill would also allow me to not need to be a commercial insurance company as a subcontractor to the CCOs I work with. And then there is a population of Oregon Health Plan enrollees that can elect by statute to not be in a coordinated care organization, but they have been they have elected to be in a dental care organization. So actually the state of Oregon approached several of the dental plans right about the time we were all contracting to ask us individually, would we continue to direct contract with them for serving only that distinct population that is allowed to be exceptions to CCO enrollment? And we are. There are approximately about 50,000 enrollees statewide who are in dental care organizations that are still direct contracting with the state of Oregon for that unique population. So this would also allow that direct contracting relationship with the state to continue for that identified population. As important as what the bill does is what it doesn't do. It doesn't change any of my contracting relationships that I have with the CCOs. It does not change any future contracting between the CCOs and dental plans, including mine. It does not change which Oregon Health Plan enrollees need to be in a CCO and which ones can be exempt because of the statutory allowances for that, and it would not change any of the parameters that the CCOs have now for contracting as direct contractors for dental services. So it really, and we worked very hard on trying to make sure that the focus of this bill was very narrowly on the issues that I just described.
Any questions? I have one question.
Sure.
Does the, if we don't have this, well, that, does that mean that the OHA will not be able to contract with DCOs without doing this?
If we don't have this and restore the direct contracting option on July 1st, 2017, when all the dental plans would go away by the previous language in the statute, they would no longer be able to direct contract.
Do you know if OHA has a position on this?
OHA had some issues that I saw in an email that were raised, and I reached out to their contact person, Brian, and shared the same testimony. They were supposed to be looking at it again, and he was to get back to me if there were any issues. The actual language I think they were looking at was that which was in Senate Bill 695, which has identical language to what's in the dash two amendment for this bill. I haven't heard back from Brian that they continue to have any issues.
You want to comment?
Nope.
It's dangerous to sit in the back there.
And then Senator Payne has a question too.
You want to ask it first?
Oh, well, you're starting to touch on it. Maybe we.
Go ahead.
So we had to, thank you, Chair Greenlick. We had a discussion, part of what we're talking about here, with the fee-for-service patients, particularly a population that is 139% to 185%. Would the DCOs, if they were able to continue to exist after 2017, be able to step in kind of as that official network for that type of population and engage with specialty referral services also?
I wouldn't be. I think the Cal or some of the populations now that are not even in dental plans that the state itself tries to deal with as a open card, as we would refer to them? Is that?
The question is, would you be willing to, would the DCOs have the ability to provide what is now on fee-for-service open card under a capitated system outside of the CCOs?
I think for those open card folks that aren't out there, I think that we would be willing to, I think our organization would be willing to have that conversation to do that.
Okay.
So that they would not be in that open card status.
And engage with referral services was the last part of that. Would you be able to guarantee that referral services specialists, even though they are limited during pregnancy, would be available to those patients?
Again, I can only speak for my own dental plan, but I think we would be willing to do that. And we would provide services the same way we would do with any of our members who are enrolled with us.
Brian, you want to comment? You don't have to.
Chair Greenlick,
I keep sandbagging you. I suppose you better just assume I might call you if you're here.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Brian Ebert, Legislative Coordinator for Healthcare Programs for the Oregon Health Authority. I purposely sit in the back so you won't sandbag me. And yes, Deborah did reach out to me. I did respond to her email today, so she may have not had an opportunity to look at our response. Unfortunately, there was I think a miscommunication we're having a meeting at 2 o'clock to discuss on the bill in the Senate 695, and hopefully can get through some of that miscommunication and confusion. We're neutral on the bill, and it should have no impact other than kind of maintaining what we do now. So
maybe
just want to provide that
clarification.
Sorry?
Is anything you can do to facilitate the communication between those two bills would be useful?
Yes. I think I'm hopeful that we'll come to some better agreement and clear up some confusion here at 2 o'clock. So we can definitely report back to you on that discussion.
Good. Excellent. Mr. Holt, you want to join us on this one? Thanks, Brian.
Should I stay?
Yeah, why don't you?
Okay.
Let's see if you want to comment on whatever he's going to comment on.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt, LaCambia Health Solutions. We're a little disadvantaged in that we're just getting a chance to hear these amendments described and their purpose, but looking at specifically in around page 13 of the bill, it's defining a CCO as being an insurer. And I think our concern here is that we take care that if the CCO is going to be defined as an insurer, that means they need to meet all of the reserve and other financial oversight requirements that insurers are required to meet. And our view toward that is, you know, the water's warm, come on in if you want to get all that oversight. But if that's not the intention, then there's probably some more work that needs to be done on this amendment.
Is that a new element?
The new element in the bill?
Yeah. Sometimes the LC moves things around, but
it appears to be new, sir.
Is that
the original underlying bill? We didn't see it doing having that same effect.
13.
Page 13.
I'm looking at page 13 of the dash two.
Of the dash twos.
What line?
What line?
Oh, sorry. At lines 14 and 15, and then at lines 30.
Yep.
So. Existing statute.
I think those are current definitions in existing statutes, Tom.
I guess I would just urge us to take a little bit of time to make sure.
Make sure that's what they are.
Make sure that we're doing what's intended here.
Okay.
If the issue is to resolve a direct contracting issue, we're certainly supportive of that.
All right. Thank you. Thank you both very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2302. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2935. What do we have there?
She should have just stayed up here.
Oh.
That's okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2935 requires the governing body of a CCO, coordinated care organization, to include a representative from at least one dental care organization that contracts with the CCOs. Declares an emergency effective on passage. And Deborah Loy and Mike Shercliffe on the panel.
Okay. Please come on up. Deborah, we're going to have to charge you extra today for your turn.
I'm going to wear a path in the carpeting.
Let's go.
Do you want to go first?
You.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Deborah Loy. I'm the Executive Director of Government Programs for Capital Dental Care. We're a dental care organization that provides care to Oregon Health Plan enrollees. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2935. House Bill 3650, again, which was passed in 2011, and Senate Bill 1580, which was passed in 2012, has legislation that transformed the Medicaid delivery system, which were part of that, and took health delivery networks, which included mental health, medical, and dental, and put them under a CCO network, or CCOs as networks. Capital Dental Care is contracted with 14 of the CCOs throughout the state. As introduced, House Bill 2935 would require a CCO to have at least one dental care organization representative on their governing board. The concept has since evolved into one that I would look at as creating perhaps a council or something that would be inclusive of all the dental plans, because oftentimes in a community, more than one dental plan is contracted with our CCOs, so having something that would be inclusive of all of the dental plan contractors. DCOs did not, or dental care organizations did not integrate with CCOs at the same time that they were being formed. So one of the reasons I feel like this bill has been introduced is we had a little bit of lag time before We were required to come into those organizations, which in many ways I'm thankful for because it allowed us to be more thoughtful about that integration. And in some ways, there's a disadvantage, too, because we've now been integrated into organizations that have been operating for some time and have mature operating structures and practices. So now how do we kind of get ourselves kind of in the mix of it? I allude to it sort of like the high school senior that enters as a senior when everybody else has sort of been there since freshman year. So how do we kind of make oral health an important piece of what the CCOs are doing? So neither House Bill 3650 or Senate Bill 1580 really had much language in it regarding what the formal relationship might be between the CCOs and the dental care organizations. The statutes that relate to those bills and the contract language doesn't really say much either. When I look at the CCO contract, there is an exhibit which lays out the organizational relationships of CCOs with many other types of organizations, and one of those in particular, as well as in the statute, is a community advisory council, which has certain responsibilities, roles, and certain functions to both contribute to the community needs assessment and the community health improvement plan. So again, somewhat as I've evolved with discussions with others on this particular bill, looking at something that would maybe be similar to that concept as a community advisory council with a person on the board, a single member on the board, being a kind of conduit of information between that council and the governing board of the CCO. I have welcomed and opened up discussions with the CCOs on helping to collaborate around this and would intend to do so until whatever final language could come up, because I definitely want this to be a collaborative process. And the bill was introduced really as a placeholder to begin that conversation and not necessarily to end it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mike Shurtcliffe. I'm a dentist and the president of Advantage Dental. We're located in Redmond, Oregon. We're owned by over 300 dentists. It's the largest independent practice association in the state of Oregon. Between Capital Dental and Advantage Dental, 65 to 70% of all Medicaid enrollees are in our plans. We're in 35 out of 36 counties and 16 of the CCOs. I come in support of this bill. As some of you know, I was actually involved with a lot of the transformation on the transformation legislation was being developed. I was asked to be the oral health representative, and I was. A couple of things that came out of that. One of them was is that we asked for time to transition because the complexity of physical health in the hospitals and the behavioral health and all of the county issues that were going on. And dentistry is only about 6% of the total spend. And in very frankly, the DCOs might have their issues, but very frankly, we were, I think, doing reasonably well given the circumstances, and so we just wanted some time so we didn't get swept up in that. I'm in support of this bill because when the legislation was written, there was some one of the House members and one of the Senate members read into the record that a DCO should be a major component of the healthcare delivery system, and that's played out kind of partially across the state. I think probably because of what Deborah talked about, which was the fact that we came in phases. What I found, and I actually sit on the Central Oregon Health Council as an oral health representative, and looking at the 16 CCOs that we deal with, the perception is the solution to this problem is just more drills, just fixing more teeth. And when you sit on the committees, that's the emphasis. And you know, I did an analysis. 350,000 adults came on the Oregon Health Plan, and if each one of those needed $2,000 worth of dental work at today's prices from paying dentists their fees, you'd be looking at about $700 million. And if you look at the budget for that, it's about $100 million. And so it's going to be very difficult to fix our way out of this problem if we don't sit at the table with our physicians and our behavioral health people and have a conversation about how do we really get the infection under control, because it truly is an infectious disease passed from primary caregiver to child, usually the mother. And the hole in the tooth you see that we try to fill is actually the symptom of the infection. And as long as we're only trying to fix that hole and don't look at the infection and look at this in a new way, we're going to fail miserably, and we're going to throw more and more money after it. And so what happens is when you don't have that viewpoint, which is a viewpoint that comes from that we've all worked on. If you don't have that viewpoint sitting at the table, you have a tendency to go to try to solve the problem rather than get the results. And so I think that and the other piece of it is the whether it's fortunate or unfortunate or whatever it is, Medicaid dentistry in Oregon is delivered by 9 dental care organizations. You know, and I could get, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years, and I've been since the beginning, and I could give you a history lesson why that is, but bottom line is that they're the only folks that stepped up to the plate and were really interested in doing it in the beginning. And very frankly, we have a divide in dentistry where 80% of the dentists look after 50% of the people, and the rest of us look after those folks. And so we have the system, and I'm quite concerned that if we don't do it right, that system is pretty fragile and might come apart. And I would like to see a DCO sitting on the board of every CCO, and so I'm coming to support this bill.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Thank you for both your testimonies. As I look at this, it's a fairly small change on line 10 of page 2, I believe, and it says what I believe you're asking to include at least one representative of a dental care organization that contracts with a coordinated care organization. It seems unclear to me whether the dental care organization is picking that representative or the CCO is picking that out of all of your 300 providers. Was there an intent there for the dental care organization to elect somebody to be that representative, or is the intent for the CCO to pick one of your dentist members?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden. What the dental care organizations did, because there's 9 of us, is what we did was we decided that amongst ourselves that whoever the largest DCO in that region was ought to be the one that, if you're going to pick somebody, that would be the one they did, or if the CCO wanted to pick somebody, that would be up to them. And that's why I think that's unclear. I think we had a kind of a previous, for example, Capital Dental sits on Long Valley Community Health, and we sit on Central Oregon Health Council because we're the largest DCOs in those regions. But that was just kind of a unspoken when we got together, how we're going to help the CCOs in the state do this. It's not formal. It's just something that evolved out of the process.
So follow up. So is the intent to have the DCO or the prior dental care organization pick a member and require the CCO to have them be that representative, or is the intent to just require the CCO to pick one of your dentist members?
It's a representative of, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden. I don't think we've got that far down in it, and so I don't want to speak to it. Okay.
Yeah, my understanding is there's new language being worked.
Yeah.
And okay. I think you need to hear those questions, because the new draft ought to make sure it answers those lines. My question is a oral health representative enough on the board, or does it need to be a DCO formal representative? It's going to be a question that's certainly going to be asked that you need to deal with.
And I think for me, similar to the community advisory council person who is on the board, definitely figuring out in conversations on how to connect that person informationally to the rest of us as a conduit of information from, you know, because in more than one area, there are several of us who are contracting with the coordinated care organizations, and it, you know, it might not be a fair thing to just have one of us. So I think whether it's a dentist and or a dental plan, and as we work through some of the details, definitely having an information connection and line to the board.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, The problem with having a dentist, just a dentist, is there's a lot that goes into organizing systems and stuff that the individual dentist might not know. And so that's why the request is for a DCO representative.
And that would probably stay in the... Well, I hope you perfect this, and particularly if you work with the CCO so they're feeling comfortable with it too, that would be very helpful.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much for bringing it forward. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2935.
Is she
here?
Yes.
And open up a work session on House Bill 2468 and ask Commissioner Cowley to join us.
Really? 2468?
It really is.
Wow.
Who do we appreciate? Commissioner Cowley, clearly.
That's going good.
Well, thank you for the enthusiastic welcome. And it's also, I'm a math geek, so I like, you know, I like the progression too. So for the record, my name is Laura Calley. I'm the insurance commissioner with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. So Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm here to talk to you about the Dash 2 amendments. When we met, I'd say probably almost a month and a half ago, we talked about the Dash 1 amendments that made most of the changes, but there were a couple of elements that weren't quite right. And so we went back and we worked with the same stakeholder group that we had worked with over the course of the last year to make sure that we had all the changes just right. And we think we are there. And so I just wanted to point out four main changes in the Dash 2s relative to the Dash 1s in the bill that we talked about earlier this session, and I'm happy to answer any questions after that. Just as a quick recap on the bill, this bill deals with network adequacy requirements for health benefit plans, and there's a transparency piece that requires display of provider directories that applies to individual small group and large group plans, and then the other part of the bill sets standards for defining what is an adequate network. Those standards would apply to individual and small group plans, and we had proposed a two-track approach that we refined a little bit in the Dash 2 amendments, but it would basically set standards for insurers to comply with to demonstrate that their networks are adequate. One of the things that we clarified in here is that the network adequacy requirements apply on a per plan basis. So for every single plan that's sold, that plan needs to have an adequate network. And so there was just a clarification to make that extra clear in the statute. And I mentioned
by every plan, you mean different plans within the same insurance company.
Chair Greenlight, that is correct. That is correct. We wanted to be sure that it's not just that, because each plan, you know, an insurer might have 10 different plans, and they might have three different networks, and so, you know, there might be three plans on one network, and another three plans on the second network, and then the last two or the last four plans might be on the third network. So the idea is that each plan has to have an adequate network, and it needs to really kind of get down to that level to make sure that a consumer, when they buy a plan, is buying a plan that gives them access to an adequate network. So we wanted to clarify that in the bill. We also clarified the way that the factor-based approach would work, and so we had talked a little bit last time about wanting to strike a balance between giving clear direction about more of a tried-and-true standard, such as a national standard like the Medicare standard that exists today that an insurer could use to demonstrate an adequate network, and that would be probably a more straightforward way of doing that, but to also foster innovation and allow for insurers to do different things to make sure people get access to care, but not be necessarily constrained by just a time and distance requirement that that currently exists in the Medicare standards, for example. So we'd propose this factor-based approach that would look at really more about, are people getting the care that they need at the time that they need it, and are they satisfied with the care, and is there transparency? So we are trying to strike that balance. And the way that the factor-based approach, this kind of more innovative approach, was described wasn't quite right. And so we've clarified that to be really clear that there are four categories of factors that in the statute. Within those four categories, the insurance division will engage in rulemaking to define different ways that a carrier might satisfy each category of factors. So we just clarified how that would work. And the idea there is that there a carrier has to show that they comply in each of the four categories, but there might be a number of ways that a carrier could comply within a category, if that makes sense. So there'd be options to show how they demonstrate transparency, for example, or access to care, and it wouldn't just be one way to do that. So we've clarified that. We've also clarified that one of the requirements that would require a provider, an insurer, to have reasonable access to healthcare professionals in areas that are designated as health professional shortage areas. Right now, it's the language is fairly broad and doesn't really just narrow it to say that an insurer has to contract with certain providers in their in the area where they actually service plans. So we just narrowed that a little bit to say you need to have these certain providers in these shortage areas if they fall within your plan service area. So it's just making sure that it's clear we're not asking insurers to go above and beyond the areas where they already sell their plans. And then the last piece is that we are proposing to repeal a duplicative statute that deals with provider non-discrimination requirements for health maintenance organizations. And we think that this is already dealt with in the other aspects of the bill, and so it's duplicative, and we're just proposing to streamline this and make it one standard that really applies broadly to all of the health insurers. And those are the main changes. I know they're kind of technical, but I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
My understanding is we haven't received any opposition from this.
Chair Greenlick, I am not aware of any. And I know there are a number of issues to kind of work out how this is all going to look, but that's going to come through rulemaking, correct?
Are there any questions?
Question.
Representative Bueller.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. I really want to support this bill because I think it's solving a real problem that's out there. But there's a few things that still concern me that I just want definition on. The first is Section 2, Subsection 1A. What happens if a carrier just simply cannot find enough providers to provide mental health and substance abuse services?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, so I think you were kind of starting to say, maybe you know, is the insurer doing everything that they can to build an adequate network, but there's either a shortage of providers or they can't get a contract, and what happens? You know, is there a situation where if it's mental health or some other service, do they then not, are they not able to sell the plan? What are the consequences? So this issue has been raised to us, and what we think makes sense is to deal with that issue when we get to rulemaking in terms of, you know, if we have an insurer who's really making good faith attempts to do everything they can, to figure out kind of what the pathway is so it doesn't, you know, limit competition and limit insurers from introducing new plans and expanding to new areas where, you know, there may be kind of some circumstances outside of their control. But I think that that's an issue we can deal with in rulemaking in terms of, you know, finding ways to kind of get closer to compliance and getting information out to consumers so that they, you know, understand what they're buying as well. But I do think that we have to recognize that there are going to be circumstances that might lead to, you know, maybe a less than ideal network. And it really may have to do with a lack of providers. And I think we have to recognize that that may be a reality.
Are you sure that can be dealt with within rulemaking? Because it says shall here in the statute.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, you know, I will confirm, but I think that we can deal with, you know, the way that we enforce this, and, you know, we might have a way to have kind of a glide path to compliance, you know, something that would basically say, if, you know, today you're not able to demonstrate an adequate network because of these reasons, there may be a way to kind of you know, report back over time or kind of work on how we might get there. And if there's an issue where the providers truly do not exist, I think we'd have to consider that because I think that we would have a situation where many carriers would have difficulty building an adequate network, and we would still want to make sure that people who live in areas, you know, where this is a problem are going to have access to health insurance. So I do think that we can have that we can deal with our enforcement of this in rulemaking that would allow us to address this issue. But I will confirm, and I'm happy to get back to
makes
you on
that.
Makes me
feel uncomfortable. I wish it was tighter in the drafting. And then same Section 2, Subsection 2A. An insurer may not discriminate respect to a participation under a health benefit. What's that mean? An insurer may not discriminate against any, basically under any willing health care provider.
Chair Greenlink, Representative Bueller, and so, sorry, I was turning my page when you were speaking, so just to confirm, we're talking about the top of page 2, section 2.
Yeah.
So this language is very similar to federal language that does the same thing, and it basically says that, you know, insurer can't, you know, can't discriminate based on, you know, the type of licensure that it that a provider has, and, you know, just basically say, well, you may be licensed to do a certain procedure. Your, the scope of your license allows you to do that, but, you know, just as a general rule, I'm not going to reimburse, you know, a chiropractor who performs that service. There are some, some different elements and some different things that insurers can do to kind of structure their their program and their reimbursement, but it's making it really clear that they can't just say, I don't contract ever with any chiropractors, or I don't ever reimburse chiropractors for this. So it's just, it's intended to make sure that we reference that that important piece of the federal law in building an adequate network.
Okay. Hey.
Chair Greenlink, thank you. Would you just address for me, I understand this is being applied to insurers, but we have several different types of entities that provide health insurance, like the Oregon Health Authority. We recently heard from DCOs, some of which are insurance companies and some of which are not insurance companies, and direct reimbursement plans that happen geographically around the area. My understanding is those would not be tied into this, and is that a concern?
Chair Greenlink, Vice Chair Hayden, so you are correct that those other entities that you mentioned would not be included in this. This would just apply to insurers who offer health benefit plans, commercial health benefit plans, so it wouldn't include...
Defined by statute.
Defined by statute. So, you know, it would carve out certain entities. So I think that there... the scope of this this issue originally was intended to help us have our own way to comply with the federal requirements that that exist right now. So the ACA has requirements for exchange plans relating to network adequacy, and the exact kind of form and structure of that is forthcoming. And so what we were intending to do here was to have to set forth state standards that would not just apply to the exchange, but would apply generally to the entire market and not kind of create two different standards. So, you know, we hadn't intended to address kind of a broader issue for other entities that we regulate, but I would mention that entities like CCOs, you know, Medicaid generally doesn't fall within our regulatory authority, so it wouldn't be generally an issue that we would, you know, we would have focused on in terms of proposing legislation. But I, you know, there may be similar issues in those other areas, but had not been the focus of this discussion at this point.
Follow up. Yeah. So I can understand that that may not be
about regulated health plans.
Yes, that may not be the arena to address it, but I think there might be an adequate reason for to have that discussion down the road. Skipping on to my second question or my follow-up question, on page 2, line 42, we're talking about prescription drugs and we can't discriminate from a drug formulary. Can you expand on that or maybe give an example of what we're trying to address here?
Chair Greenlink, Vice Chair Hayden. So the language that you're referring to, we actually propose to remove with the Dash 2 amendments.
Okay.
And it's very complicated. You have to have someone spend a lot of time lining out things, as I've found, to make sure you get it all quite right. But we are proposing to remove that because we think that this is an issue that requires more discussion. When we had done our stakeholder work over the last year, really the focus was on the provider network adequacy and not looking more deeply at the prescription drug issue, which we know is an important issue, but has its own complexities. So we are proposing to remove it, not because we don't think it needs to be addressed, but we think this is probably not the appropriate vehicle and that we would need more discussion.
So one more follow-up?
Yes.
Then in the summary, does the Dash 2 amendment take out the last sentence of the summary where it prohibits insurer from using drug formulary that discriminates against the enrollee on the basis of health status in the actual summary of the bill.
Chair Green, like Vice Chair Hayden, I do not see in the dash twos that it does change that summary, but I'm happy to follow up and see if that's something that needs to be changed.
Yeah, we need to make sure we have the right summary when it goes to the floor.
Right.
It seems like that summary would need to be updated with the dash two.
Thank you.
Sometimes we do read.
Okay. Let's move into a work session. We're in a work session. Can we have a motion?
Chair Green, I move to adopt the dash two amendments dated 3/13/2015.
Representative Hayden moves to adopt the dash two amendments to House Bill 2468, dated March 13th, 2015. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Is there any objection? All right, the main bill.
Chair Greenlink, I move House Bill 2468 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hayden moves House Bill 2468 as amended with the dash two amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Could you please call the roll?
Representative Hubert?
Yes.
Representative Klim?
Aye.
Representative Kennemer?
Aye.
Representative Penny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Somebody wake him
I'm
up.
I'm excused
over there.
From the vote.
I didn't see you down there.
He's so quiet.
He's so quiet.
You're not excused.
Unusually quiet.
Unusually quiet.
Sorry, please keep going. He's not excused. He must vote.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye.
Chair Green?
Aye. Motion carries.
Carrier.
We have a carrier.
You don't want me to carry it because I might vote no on the floor.
I'll carry it, and you can get to help me. Work session closed on House Bill 2468, and open up a work session on House Bill 2930. What do we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2930 had a public hearing on March the 6th. You'll recall that it requires hospitals to adopt rules granting admitting privileges to nurse, midwife, nurse practitioners, prohibits the hospitals from requiring licensed NMNPs to co-admit patients with physician who has admitting privileges, and prohibits the healthcare facility from denying voting rights of a medical staff to a nurse practitioner who is granted admitting privileges at the facility. We have a dash two amendment before us that specifies that a hospital rules may grant the privileges and regulate the credentialing to the nurse practitioners, and it specifies what criteria to be used for the rule drafting.
And my understanding is the hospitals are fine with the dash twos, is that?
That is mine as well. And we have a thumbs up in the back of the room.
Okay.
Okay.
So do we have to move the dash two?
Yeah, a motion?
Chair Greenlink, I move to adopt the dash two amendments dated 3/12/2015.
Representative Hayden moves we adopt the dash two amendments to House Bill 2930, dated 3/12/15. Is there any discussion on the amendments? Is there any objection to the amendments? So moved.
Chair Greenlick.
Hayden.
Chair Greenlick, I move House Bill 2930 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hayden moves House Bill 2930 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended with the dash twos with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Would you call the roll, please?
Yes.
Representative Klim?
Aye.
Representative Kennemer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2930 is on its way to the floor as amended. Volunteer to carry it?
I'd love to, but Representative Kennemer, you want to do it with me?
That'd be
fine. We're the two co-chiefs.
Okay, let's do that.
Representative Kennemer, Representative Kenny Geyer. Let's see. We can do it alphabetically if we can figure out who's first alphabetically. I'll close the work session.
Ladies first.
Or Representative Kenny Guyer either. House Bill, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2930. Thank you for staying. I'm going to open up an informational meeting with our new director of the Oregon Health Authority, we waited on asking her to talk to us until she was confirmed, but she has been now, and we even have a few extra minutes for her. So.
Thanks.
This is important, as I've stressed to Director Saxon, that this committee has the primary responsibility on the House side for the Oregon Health Authority stuff. That's a pretty big task. So the more we know about OHA, the better we can do our job.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. I appreciate the importance of this role, and particularly to this committee. And what I'd like to do is...
Would you please introduce yourself?
I'm Lynn Saxton. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Authority. Thank you. I have handed out one of the items I'm going to talk about briefly, which I think is illustrative of the approach we're going to be using increasingly at the Oregon Health Authority to drive results. But let me just give you an overview of where we are, and happy to answer any questions. When I first communicated with the Oregon Health Authority workforce on January 2nd, I started this position on January 20th, I outlined four priorities for our work together in the coming year. And those priorities are, first and foremost, to provide quality care. We will continue to identify and support best practice, outcomes-driven initiatives, and systems to ensure Oregonians receive quality care at reasonable cost. It's job one. It's the most important thing we do, and it requires constant vigilance to ensure that we deliver on that promise. Secondly, one of the pieces of work that is critical to the future of healthcare and healthcare transformation in Oregon is financial sustainability. We're going to ensure that we're engineering a financially sustainable healthcare system that is efficient, compliant, and effective. That has a number of dimensions, everything from at the micro level, ensuring that the managers at the Oregon Health Authority itself have dashboards that give them regular reporting capacity on financial status and implementation, all the way to a five-year projection that we are currently working on for this committee and our other stakeholders that shows the implications of healthcare transformation going forward, specifically as we move forward without the $1.9 billion subsidy that we've had in the past several years. Also, as the federal investment in healthcare declines and what we look like in that changing environment. That's an analytical product that's underway, and we'll have that in April. One of the critical aspects of that effort is to sustain bending the cost curve like we have in the past several years. Oregon is ahead of some states in bending the cost of health care, and we're behind some other states. So we're benchmarking ourselves closely to what's happening across the country and looking for the best practices and initiatives that will ensure that we continue to provide quality care at sustainable cost. A third element of financial sustainability, which received some press coverage recently, just to orient you to that, is that we are in the process of working with our CCO partners to redevelop the 2015 rates. Those rates are in place, and we're well aware of the complexity of looking at those rates because those rates are currently contracted. But we felt it was necessary to take one more walk through that work as we prepared for setting 2016 rates, which is also work underway, to ensure that we were building health system transformation on a solid financial actuarial footing. We have the blessing of CMS in doing that redevelopment. We've worked closely with the coordinated care organizations to engage them in this process, and I think it's part of building the infrastructure for our sustainable future. Thirdly, it's very important that we successfully implement the coordinated care model, and equally important to the Oregon Health Authority is we need to structure ourselves consistent with implementation of the coordinated care model. So the world looks different now that the 16 CCOs are stood up, and 2 weeks ago we announced a phased restructuring of the Oregon Health Authority, which we completed internal announcements on last Thursday, that restructures basically the entire agency with a focus to results and 21st century management practices. And we expect that implementation of the restructure to be completed by July 1st of this year, so that we're synced up with our biennial budget.
Could you outline that for us as a priority?
Yes, I will. And I have a picture here, which I'm happy to hand around. I don't have copies. I'm sorry. We couldn't get our big copier to print this morning. But I'll just pass this around while I'm talking for your review.
Maybe we can get copies.
Don't forget the copier is working right.
That's tomorrow's job.
Yeah. So you have to figure out which button to press.
I tried everything except for kicking and, you know, acting out. But I think the most important part of this restructure, which I would call your attention to, is in addition to the fact that I will have, there's several critical parts, so let me go through those for you. First of all, our tribal relationship reports directly to me. That's a critical relationship for us based on the special legal status of the 9 federally designated tribes in Oregon, and also having worked with the 9 federally designated tribes intensely as a provider for the last 8 years, it's important to me as we see the metrics emerging for our tribal partners that we address disproportionality concerns quickly. And so that position will continue to report to me. We will also have a chief operating officer with that portfolio, but most significant of these transitions is the creation of a chief health systems officer. That position is the single door of responsibility, if you will, to the coordinated care organizations. Currently, coordinated care organizations for the last couple of years have gone through multiple doors, getting multiple answers, and causing a lot of unnecessary anxiety and frustration. So we're going to consolidate those operations, including the rate setting function, which is key again to marry not just health system transformation, but to marry it with the financial rigor that is required to have health systems transformation. They go hand in glove. Further, you'll see an identification of the addictions and mental health and it's now called MAP. It used to be called DMAP, but it's the medical assistance programs. Those two departments, which are currently freestanding, go into the health systems portfolio with regard to Medicaid services. So AMH services currently serving the Medicaid population will move to the health systems portfolio. And behavioral health that is population health-based services, people not being served by Medicaid, will be a separate direct report of Pam Martin reporting to me on behavioral health. We maintain the structure of the public health department, although we have added to their management portfolio to include public health licensing that previously was managed separately. So that's all consolidated in one reporting chain. And two other additions, the Office of Equity and Inclusion reports directly to me. External relations communications and internal communications will report to me. And finally, health policy and analytics will be consolidated. All policy initiatives and activities will be consolidated under health policy. Currently, we have health policy distributed throughout the organization, and it makes it hard to bring focus and integrate both our work, but also for external relations of the agency. It's been very complex, and we're going to simplify that for people. So that's kind of the summary of the reorg in a nutshell. The design and the implementation of the restructure is being done using lean processes. Linda Hammond, who is retiring from the state of Oregon but is sufficiently excited by this project, I've offered her that she's going to help us get each of the divisions through the lean process. And we will be taking a particular eye to the way the whole health system in Oregon looks differently, who the clients are, and how we can be more responsive and effective with the clients that we serve. That's been a barrier for us in the transition from being part of the Department of Human Services to being the Oregon Health Authority to the stand-up of the CCOs. So we expect to make some significant gains in our client relations as well. I want to just mention, as you're looking at that, and I'm happy to answer questions as well, as in addition to restructuring the agency, which we announced starting 2 weeks ago, we are creating for our Ways and Means presentation, I'm calling it a draft, but we're doing a map of the mental health continuums in Oregon and the at four levels, adult, adolescent, family, and child. That map will show where mental health services are delivered across the state, the scope of that continuum, particularly in terms of what we now know is best practice for mental health. And it will identify both gaps in services and help us guide resources appropriately. Right now, we have parts of the state that have very robust mental health portfolios, and we have other parts of the state where we have huge gaps in what's available. And as part of this responsibility for integrating behavioral, mental, and dental health, we need to look at where those gaps are in the mental health system.
It would be great if you share that with us when it's
of course.
When it's ready.
We will have a draft by April, but I'm setting low expectations because I'm just going to tell you it's not been done before and it's going to be hard to do, so it will be
you won't
a draft.
Do it by April.
What?
You won't get it done by April.
Like, yeah, we will. The other thing that we're doing is we've just hired our first dental officer, and we're very excited about that. I'm particularly excited about a partnership we have with the Oregon Community Foundation, where they are providing venture capital, if you will, to help us launch the dental care system in a way that gets the social needs met of clients so that they are efficient and timely consumers of dental services. That's been a barrier for some of the populations we work with. It's been a challenge for the dental offices, and we appreciate the partnership of the Oregon Community Foundation to do that work. Finally, the fourth thing that I talked about to our workforce in early January and that we're working on already is the critical need, as we look at the metrics that we're generating through the work we've done so far, and if you haven't gone online and looked at the metrics from health system transformation, it's really fun. It's a tool and an opportunity that, you know, I'm old enough to say didn't used to exist. We can now look at areas of the state where there are very robust services that are being executed beautifully and successfully, and we can look at other areas of the state where there are needs, and we can pair those people together and say, boy, look what they're doing in Klamath Falls, and can we export that to another environment to ensure the results we want? So I encourage you to do that. But one of the things that pops up when you review those metrics is that we are already showing some disproportional results with some populations in the state. For example, we're having a hard time getting African American women to their prenatal visits as fast as we need to. And so we're going to be taking a special look this year at what specific interventions we need to create and work with the CCOs to ensure that the early indicators in those metrics do not become baked in something that we're all talking about 5 years from now. Our experience is that if you can get on those problems fast with targeted interventions based on data and best practice, you can turn them around pretty quickly. There's some work, for example, being done with Hispanic populations in Southern Oregon that is making faster gains than in any other part of the state. Well, part of what this system should deliver to Oregon is the opportunity to manage resources more effectively throughout the state by looking at best practices already deployed and implemented. Finally, I just want to call your attention to this determination and enrollment project because it shows how we're approaching our work. This is the work we did to improve the redetermination process. We were having real challenges. Wait times were excessive. Frustration levels were excessive, and particularly one of my concerns is we were imposing additional costs on various parts of the system that the system had not been designed to bear. So, for example, if we're not getting enrollment taken care of in an efficient manner, then those challenges go to the CCOs, and they have to hire more staff to get on the phones, and it's just kind of the problem just moves down the line or up the line, as it will. So we have made significant gains. We will continue to make significant gains. But what we're also very excited about is as a metrics-driven organization for healthcare transformation, it's important that we use those tools for internal management as well. And so this was something new for us. The first version of it that we did, staff came and said, we don't really want to print this, do we? We don't really want to show this to anyone. And I said, actually, we do, because if we show them where we're starting, they'll be really impressed by where how quickly we get to where we want to be. So this, we will be using tools like this for performance measurement in other aspects of the organization as we go forward. And I have to say that the response from the people who are on the phone lines with the redeterminations, and they're using really clunky software under really tough kind of, you know, computer logistics. But when they initially, we showed this to them and we set new expectations and goals for volume of calls and response time and all that, the response was pretty concerning. They were concerned. We provided additional training. We changed our technology format, asked our vendors to do a better job. And the result was that we've had a lot of excitement on the workforce there about, you know, wow, look at this. We're really kicking it now in some sectors. Again, what this shows you is we're not as good as we need to be or want to be. But we look forward to using this kind of approach going forward to ensure that we're meeting our objectives. I think that's probably enough from me, unless you'd like to ask me questions. I'm happy to talk further about, I have a list here of the things that we've particularly done well over the last 2 years. I know there's been a lot of talk about the things that have not gone well, but I have the list of things that are really going well, and I'm happy to share them, and cost savings, etc. I also have a list that we're using to manage our plan for going forward of some of the real challenges that we face and things we need to do differently than we have done in the past in order to be successful.
I would encourage you to keep going, and I'll encourage the committee to interrupt at any time if they have questions.
Maybe just give you a break and ask a question.
Sure.
So I'm interested in the main challenges that you see right now, Lynn, after your short duration on the job.
So the first challenge is financial sustainability. That's the one that, you know, the what are you losing sleep on? I have this graph in my head every night, and I'm moving the numbers. So I'll feel a lot better when I get that first draft. So that's a challenge. It was not an easy thing to do to say we would redevelop the 2015 rates, because that's a difficult thing for the CCOs to do. But having put it in motion, it gives me a little comfort that we're going to build a solid foundation. The second challenge, which we're addressing and is really critical, that I haven't mentioned, is we have to get to Kentucky. I'm calling it the March to Kentucky. We need viable software that works for doing this work. One of the cornerstones of healthcare transformation and healthcare, period, is having the right data tools and the right software. So we have to get to the Kentucky software, and we'll get there by December, but we need to do it with a great deal of discipline and focus. Part of what that challenge looks like is we have to tell people that we can't do it all, and that it won't be perfect, and that it won't do everything immediately. We have to lower expectations, so that part of the reason Kentucky was successful is they did not have mission creep or scope creep, and they stayed very focus. So that's the second challenge. The third challenge is, I think, which again is, I think, perhaps the easiest solved, is the healthcare debate, which has occurred in the country and occurred in the state, has a lot of people very confused. And they're...
Really?
Including us.
It's,
yes.
It's, and, in fact, we see that in our conversations with the Medicaid population. They're very confused, and confusion causes anxiety. So part of what we have an obligation to do is to prioritize the debates we're going to have around healthcare so that we can make progress but keep people in the game. And part of what we have to do is really own the piece of getting people to speak to common data. So one of the first things I noticed when I came was all these conversations and anecdotal stories were shared with me, and I kept saying, well, where is that? Or who... What does that look like? And so we are using the practice now of putting, particularly on more robust public policy discussions that we're having, whether at the Health Policy Board or in other venues, of putting the data set on the table to start so that we're speaking to what Oregon looks like, to what is actually happening. And part of what's helpful in that process for other challenges is we're identifying what we don't know at the same time. So those would be my top three.
Follow-up, sure. Can you give us a sense of an estimate of what the budget shortfall would be in the next biennium? Do you have a sense of that as the federal money starts to ratchet away?
I can in about 2 weeks.
Okay.
It's underway, but I don't have it for you today.
Okay. Please send us a memo on that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Great. It'll be a bestseller.
Yeah. One more question.
Yeah.
Representative Lively?
Thank you, Director Saxton. First, I want to say that I appreciate having managed large contact centers. Metrics are very important, and even if they don't show the story who you want to get, they're important to understand the tracking of that. So I appreciate it. So the question I really have, though, and I have heard good things about the work already done and improving times, but is this something that we'll repeat? My understanding is, given what we went through last year and the changes we had to make, mm-hmm. that maybe this is the demand is worse in this year than going forward if we get onto the Kentucky system or whatever it is, to where we won't have these big lumps at the enrollment time of people calling, or is that not true? Is this something in this process we'll face every year at this time when we go through enrollments?
Chair Green,
just answer the question.
So my expectation is that it will not repeat. So we had two dynamics this year. One is we had this clunky software situation, and then we had the Affordable Care Act enrollment, and it came in much differently than everyone expected, both on a local level and a national level. So my expectation is that we'll get it stabilized, and part of what we are working with our community of sisters on, which is absolutely key, is we have a responsibility to educate the Medicaid population on the requirements of Medicaid. So, and some of these exercises existed, when any program like this goes on. You have to educate the users, and the fact, for example, that you have to report your income every year, that you have to qualify, be redetermined every year, that's an important piece. I think further, our hope would be that the growth in the population stabilizes over time, because currently there's 1,055,000 people on these services, and that's about a quarter of the population of Oregon. So my expectation is we do better, but I'm also going to be very careful to say that Kentucky will not be a panacea, and it will not start with just, flip a switch and everything's better.
Thank you.
Representative Bueller, you had another question?
Yeah, thank you, Chair.
And Representative Hayden.
Lynn, I share your concerns with regards to our mental health care delivery system in the state. Is there something we can do as a health care committee to help you in that transformation and addressing those needs?
Thank you, Representative Bueller. That would be much appreciated. I think, again, part of what we wanted to do is get the map done first. And that map will be have layers of kind of the financing and the funding. And I think when we get that composite picture taken, we want to come back to you and come to you both with proposals that need to address some of those challenges. And also, it will be a big advantage to have a clarity on where the investments are being made, because my sense right now is that we have that it's a little random if you have a mental health problem and you're in Oregon, what kind of services you get. It's a little determined by history, by whether you're rural or urban, and other variables. So we're hoping to kind of peel that back and come to you with asking support for an improved system.
I'd like to follow up on that question before we go to the next one. This is a huge worry for us. We feel, I think most of us, that the mental health system is broken and that we need to find a new way. My question relates to your table of organization, which has a big part of it being the CCO part in a different line than the community part. And they're so heavily linked together that, does that worry you at all? And also, I see sort of the state hospital just sort of down at the bottom of some line. Oh, yeah. Oh, hey, we forgot the state hospital, which is also a big part of the problem. Does that?
So that's a great question, and let me just answer it in two steps. First of all, I think that we feel internally that part of the challenge right now with the system is that the perception that AMH is independent or separate from the CCO delivery system. And we have another partner in that delivery system, which is the counties in Oregon. So our expectation is, by having the Medicaid portion of behavioral health aligned with the CCOs, that we will have a better ability to produce results. I think it actually will be a step forward in a lot of integrative kind of ways. The state hospital is currently under population behavioral health because of the Department of Justice relationship that we have for the state hospital today, and because we've begun our own internal assessment of where those clients are coming from and going to. About half of them are not in the Medicaid system, and they're in the justice system more than they are in the CCO part of the frame.
So, more than two-thirds, in fact, are in the justice system.
So part of what we will do is be looking at that and then identifying the go-forward plan for the state hospital. I do want to just underscore, I have spent a lot of time at the state hospital. I've toured the state hospital. We just had our joint commission review of the state hospital, and I'm going to share that report with all of you, because the praise was glowing for what Greg Roberts has accomplished. I have to tell you, having gone through the old state hospital and the current state hospital and looked particularly, my particular focus based on 13 years in mental health is, are the people in the state hospital experiencing a full life in terms of future jobs, future opportunities, socialization, et cetera? And I think the model that we are delivering at the Oregon State Hospital today is best practice. We'll get better. There's no question we continue to have gains. But for the time being, we're leaving it in that sector so it will get the attention it deserves, and then we'll evolve over time.
Representative Hayden?
Chair Green, look, I had two questions, and I think these questions are developing, but you said as far as budgeting shortfalls, you're looking at what's going to happen in 2017 and some of the ACA mandates not being as fully funded with the $1.9 billion that the state originally got. My challenge or my question to that is that I hope that includes the 2018 look at the excise tax. I think I'm starting to hear that it will be included in that conversation, so maybe you could follow up a little bit what that means when we say we think we're addressing it. And my second question to mental health, I'll just ask them at the same time here, is would it be possible to come up with an aggregating of the counties, say nine counties, creating four mental health districts to be a step between the individual 36 counties and the state hospital for the appropriate, maybe the 370, so those individual counties could get together and utilize joint resources, but still trying to say geographically located to where say, 9 counties, you know, 36 divided by 4 is 9 counties each, where they could have collaborative efforts to work on a mental health issue together rather than each county trying to bear that responsibility individually.
Representative Hayden, I think both points are well taken. The first of all, the excise tax, we'll be factoring that into our five-year look chart, but we're also doing, based on the conversation that we had with you this week, kind of more explanation on the details of that, and I'm not comfortable speaking to those today because I'm not fully aware myself of all the implications, but we have that on the
radar.
On the radar screen. And then the idea with the counties is a very interesting one, and we can certainly look at that. One of the things that we're seeing, and part of the reason for doing the map, is that we're seeing some counties are just being very entrepreneurial with both the with all aspects of the mental health population. And that's why we have to do the map, because once we look at what we've got where and how it works together now, we can talk about what we can move to from there. I will say that the, you know, another really critical part of that look is to look at the state facilities that are, you know, we have a lot of mental health facilities now that are regional in their service scope, and that's part of the reason we want to do the map, because with all people with mental health issues, the goal needs to be to get them as close to their community of support as possible, and we think there's an opportunity to do that better, too. I mean, part of what helps mentally ill people succeed is having communities of support around them, and so we're going to look at that geographic aspect for the regional facilities.
Thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you kind of touched on something a little bit that I don't know if you've looked at Yamhill County and what they've been doing there. They've actually integrated the community pretty heavy into their CCO, the mental health and everything. And I don't know.
And early childhood.
And early childhood as well. So I don't know if you've got a chance to really look at what's going on there, but not to toot the horn of my own district, but the model and direction we went, I actually am pretty supportive of.
Yep. Representative Widener, you should be tooting your own horn. I have looked at and met with the CCO leadership from Yamhill County, and they're doing some very impressive work, particularly at the community level, integrating things to produce results. So that's very exciting. They absolutely.
An example of when the government takes control rather than worrying about private enterprise. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't think you're up.
Mr. Chair, if I had my way, all the money would be going to our counties to implement this, and we would cut the Oregon Health Authority in half as well. So,
I'm not going to comment on that. I will say, too, that part of what we're seeing across the state, which is also exciting, is we're seeing some of the CCOs engage successfully on the healthcare side with the early learning hubs and initiatives, and that's producing results as well.
Yeah, I think that was an amazing piece. The CCO taking over the early childhood hub was quite extraordinary.
Impressive.
Representative Nose.
I did not have a question.
Oh.
Bueller had a question.
Thank you.
Another question?
Thank you, Chair Nose.
Okay.
I'd just like to comment to the chair that the government's taken over the financing of health care, but delivery still in private hands. So.
Oh.
That's right.
Which is an interesting concept to think about for other things, too. But I like the idea, Lynn, of mapping out the mental health care delivery system. Are you doing a similar map with regards to the financing of the mental health care system? Because it seems like there's funds flowing from lots of different places, and it may be helpful.
So I think that, Representative Bueller, I think that's an excellent idea. I think one of the things we're trying to do is sequence the work. So I think once we're doing the mental health mapping and the five-year financial projection first as part of our ways and means commitment, but we certainly will go back to the financing on the whole health system and map that as well, because it is critical. And particularly what you'll see on this chart is you'll see money dropping off, right? And big chunks of money. So we're going to be looking at that. And just a related piece, in the restructure of the Oregon Health Authority that we are implementing, we will be looking at those eight functional areas you saw by funding source as well. So we'll be mapping it organizationally, which will help us as we go forward.
I have another question. My nightmare when I get woken up for things other than being an old man has to do with the future of the CCOs. The assumption is, in order to stay under that 3.4% or whatever that percentage, they can bend the cost curve. And by bending the cost curve, it means to me they find a way to change the production function for healthcare. Mm-hmm. The savings so far that I see are really the low-hanging fruit. You get people out of the emergency room, and that keeps them out of the hospital. You give them access to primary care in some way, and it makes some things less use of crazy specialty care. But the real question is there any indication that the CCOs, I don't mean for you to answer this, but what we need to look at, what we need to pay attention to is there any indication that the CCOs are literally doing something that changes the financing and delivery of the healthcare system? For example, we capitate the HMOs, the CCOs, and there's only one that I know of, I think it's the Deschutes County group, that's actually subcapitating in a real way to other elements of their delivery system. But it seems to me it's very hard to change the way we deliver healthcare in any basic way, but I don't think we'll achieve what we're trying to do if we don't. I wonder if you would have a comment about that.
So one of the reasons, it is a very valid question, as one of the CCOs put it to me, when are we going to get to buy the air conditioner, right? Because we've all heard the metaphor about using the air conditioner to transform healthcare.
And it's up to them.
And
I hope that's the answer.
Yes.
Whatever you want to is
yes.
the answer.
And part of what the discussion we're having with them, and we'll probably have it first in the context of mental health, is as one doctor told me yesterday, you know, we've given the funding, not all the mental health, but we've given funding to the CCOs, and now we need to ensure that they actually transform healthcare. Now, so that's work to be done. We do know that some of that transformation has already occurred, and we can see it in the metrics. So I think what we're seeing is, and CMS validates our perception of having made gains in this area. We are making some gains faster than any other states in the country. We are making some savings more successfully than other parts of the country, and they attribute it to the CCO model and how things are going. I think the challenge when I was first talked to about this opportunity, the challenge now is a lot. The next gains are harder fought, and they have a lot to do with implementation and execution. And that's the rigor that we are going to bring to the Oregon Health Authority. To your point, if everything were done at the CCO level, the question is how much of an Oregon Health Authority do you need to do the other things? I think we're looking at what that work is. And secondly, we have to execute it with rigor. Part of that will be, and that's why I showed you the chart of the redetermination. There are lots of conceptual ideas about ways to bend healthcare costs. However, if you aren't precise about how to do that, they can escape you. So, for example, we've looked at a couple processes with the CCOs where there's too much process between the healthcare received and the starting point. And some of that is us, you know, being in the middle and not being efficient ourselves. So we're starting with our own operation first. We're using this lean process that is best practice. We're going to look at how we're integrating effectively with the CCOs, but part of what we're also going to be looking at is the ROI on the funding, per client cost of care, and what's actually being delivered. And I think it's hard work. I think we can do it. I think we're off to a very good start in having, as far as I can tell, one of the best analytic and metric teams in the state. And that really is, we're respected for that by private sector, public sector, et cetera. And that's kind of the jewel in our crown that we need to leverage to get these results.
Well, I hate to take exception to what you say, but the fact is, when I read the quality of care metrics, I don't think we're doing very well at all. I think we've met goals, but we met goals against baseline that was abysmal. And there are a few bright lights, but you, at least five of the CCOs failed on 12 of the 17 measures, even with an abysmal baseline that they should have been able to walk through. I think the fact that somebody had to ask you when did they get to buy that air conditioning indicates that they're stuck in old models. I mean, you know, the answer is, give me a new code so I can charge for mental health services. Well, that's just completely crazy. I mean, I think it needs some ideas, and I'm not sure where those ideas are coming from. And I hope there'll be some way that you can push on those and reward the ideas that are there and take barriers away from doing things that people want to try and do things in some different and unusual way. But
duly noted.
Sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry.
You're late. I've been looking at you.
I just wanted. Well, you stimulated me to say something.
Yeah, one more minute. Say something.
But okay.
I completely agree with you, Chair Greenlee. The challenge of someone having been in that situation, both in a practice and as a director of a health system, let me think of the right analogy. It's like driving a car down the road with a certain engine that's providing the power, the current kind of volume-based, where's my code, reimbursement system. And while keeping that car driving down the road, you have to change out the engine to the volume-based, take care of people, still take care of your employees and move it down the road. And exactly how you switch that engine out is very tricky. And I agree the engine has to be switched, but it's hard to do while keeping the car on the road.
Yeah, when GM wanted to invent a new way to build cars, they built a new plant. They didn't try and change it while they were delivering the existing car.
Yeah, but we still have to take care of people.
Exactly. We don't have that luxury. Yeah. One very brief statement. And then
thank you, Mr. Chair. It's actually kind of a question statement. I applaud what you just taking on this challenge, Lynn, to be honest with you, because that's what it is. But it also puts you to where you actually get to model this. And I think one of the things you need to consider is funds are going to go down. There's not going to be as much money. And this is why I'm kind of a proponent of letting the counties have it. And the health authority.
Look at what a great job you're doing with the mental health system.
The Oregon Health Authority is putting together the plan. We're the CEO kind of the company, and we failed on education, lots of different things as being the CEO, but you putting together the model where you go in and you work with that CCO, and this is how we disperse, how we implement, and get everybody on the same page and keeping the team so we can keep most of the funds going in to the local communities to help people, because we're going to have, I mean, we could see cuts to where we're down $5,000 a year per patient versus $10,000 a year a patient. And then, well, Dr. Buehler's right, or Representative Buehler's right. I mean, when you're working in the local communities, the local CCO is going to have the relationships with all the private providers to get things done. And where somebody falls out of that, they also know the church that's there to go get some of the services or help that somebody might need, because they'll fall out of a category or something like that. So I'd like to see us reduce the Oregon Health Authority, and to make that part of your goal, to have a staff reduction so more money can be on the front line.
The Oregon Health Authority, as I remember the number, spends less than 10% of its budget internally, and 90% of the budget is sent to your communities. Isn't that number very similar to that number?
It is. Your point, to me, I think there's a question. I'm principally focused on results and outcomes, and I think that's why I was asked to do this work, and actually have operated in the last 5 years of my professional life in an environment where there's never enough money, and you're still expected to perform at an 80% or higher level. And we did it. And we did it by paying close attention to transformation, to results, et cetera. So I think the question is, and I'm happy, and I think the I don't know if we will be the first agency to have all divisions go through a lean process, but we may be. And I'm happy to have the discussion once we go through and look at that as for the Oregon Health Authority. To me, there it isn't a right number to cut or a right number to have. It's we need to spend a certain amount of money and get terrific results for Oregonians, and that's the page I'm on. And I think we do that collaboratively. I think we do that with a great deal of focus, and I totally agree that it's very hard to do, and it may be impossible, but we're committed to trying.
Lynn, thank you so very much for coming and being open. We'll continue to hear from you. I just reminded one more time that we carried over.
These are the tax credits.
A bill to next Monday. What was that? 2642 the next Monday. I'll close the informational hearing.
I know they want it on the same side.
And we are adjourned. We are adjourned.
I know they want it on the same side.